Team Human is not brought to you by Squarespace or MailChimp, but by the team itself. I get so many emails every day from people wanting to know how to join Team Human. And what I answer them is, you're already on Team Human. Just to be on Team Human, just play, encounter others, engage with your own communities. But another way to make it official is to become a paying supporter of the show. Get our bonus content every other week, like this week's conversation with Jenny Hardin that I did, 10, 15 years ago. Our conversations with Timothy Leary, Paul Krasner, all sorts of interesting folks. You can come to special events in our new Spatial Audio Lounge. You get invitations and free admission to our live events once they start up again, and access to our Discord channel, and most importantly, to one another. So find the others like Matt Klein, Tina Matthews, Julia Sheehy, Pat, and Chris Howell by going to teamhuman.fm and clicking on support, or going to patreon.com/teamhuman and signing up. You're on Team Human, Conscious Intervention in the Machine, a celebration of the truly non-fungible reality in which we live. We are not numbers, we cannot be copied, and we are worth more than mere tokens. I am not my private key, and I'm not on any blockchain. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Playing for Team Human today, socialite, mischief maker, and self-described shit starter, Kenya Robinson.
There are tremendous joys and challenges that come along with it, especially at this time, in this place. But we all got born.
Robinson will be sharing her approach to artistic provocation as a Black Southern woman in a world that's still challenged by ambiguity. It's time to intervene on behalf of people. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and I'm on Team Human. Hello, my faithful teammates. It's good to be with you. It's been an odd time these last few weeks. We've filled with hype and hope and despair and rage, all sorts of things. First off, everybody, please continue to offer yourselves and each other as much slack as possible. I know there's a lot of folks that are I don't know, a lot of liberals guilting each other about being too relaxed now that Biden is president. First, I don't think anyone is too relaxed right now with COVID and the economy and wars looming and all sorts of stuff going on, and the Georgia voting rights being curtailed and state legislatures around the country trying to pass laws that say it's okay to overturn elections if the Republican legislature doesn't like it. There's enough to worry about. I think it's okay to let up. You know, I think this whole idea of not letting up, don't let up, stay glued to your cable station and watch all the stuff and keep yourself in a heightened state of righteous indignation at all times, I don't know that that's a great thing either. You don't have to be involved in politics 24/7, 365 days a year, unless you're a political operative or you're in politics or something. The rest of us can do civics. You know, civics is something different than politics. Civics is local. Civics is just helping other people. You know, it's starting alternative currencies and getting people signed up for COVID shots, or helping your schools build tents so they can do classes outside, or looking and doing things for the homeless and soup kitchens and food pantries. You know, politics deserves a rest. You deserve a rest. It's really okay not to be plugged into world events over which you have little authority 24/7, right? You can instead chill on some of that. You just lived through one of the most contentious, horrible election cycles in U.S. history, and in some ways, since ever. It's okay to just let up on that and be nice to people, do things for others, get engaged locally. In some ways, the time you spend watching MSNBC or whatever thing you listen to is time that could better be spent actually just doing stuff. I did watch a little bit of politics this week, though, in spite of my letting myself off. I watched Joe Biden's press conference, and I'll tell you, I got a little creeped out, you know, not by anything he was saying. I thought he had good command of the facts, and I'm interested to see if this kind of FDR-like bold government spending action stuff, how that works. I've never really lived through something like that either. But watching him, I felt that sort of uncanny valley thing that sometimes happens when I'm watching a 3D animation of something. I feel like his plastic surgery has rendered his face incapable of making appropriate emotional expressions. His eyes seem pinned back and stuck, giving him this deer in the headlights, helpless look, which really plays into the Republican narrative about him being feeble and incompetent. He looks like he's afraid all the time because his eyes are wide open, like a little kid in fear. And it's really not worth it. I get it. He didn't like being called Sleepy Joe or whatever they were calling. He didn't want to look too old to be president. But old and expressive, old and available, old and in this moment is better than apparently younger, but trapped in time, but stuck. It's a really good lesson, not just for those of us considering plastic surgery, but a good lesson about actually inhabiting the moment that you're in, whatever is going on, before you try to lock down something else or correct it or compensate. That almost all compensation ends up creating a kind of brittleness. I think it's okay to just be. Just fall into who you are and see what that is. And you will, for whatever you lack, you will always be more available to the moment you're in if you're actually in that moment. And boy, you know, for a guy as spontaneous and pro-human as Biden means to be, I think it's a mistake. No more surgeries, Biden, no more surgeries, okay? Just leave things the way they are. You'll be fine. But the thing I really wanted to talk about this week are NFTs. NFTs. I'm getting so many emails about NFTs, all these opportunities and offers to do NFTs of my books or the podcast or drawings or team up on NFTs. And for those of you who don't understand what NFTs are, and I'm sure there's many who just missed the whole phenomenon. You've heard the word and it's just like hearing, you know, Bitcoin or something, and it doesn't mean anything to you. All NFTs are, it's a phrase that means non-fungible token. And it's a way to take something that's really copyable, like a graphic file that you want to be art, you want to be original, you want it to be a collector's item, but you kind of can't because anyone could just make an equal copy of it. Well, what you do is you kind of give it a serial number, you attach it to a blockchain so that the world knows that this belongs to you, that this is your thing, that you can buy it and own it and have it associated with you or your number if you want to be anonymous, so that you own this great piece of work. So if, you know, Banksy or some artist has a graphic and anyone could copy the graphic, anyone could put it on their desktop, anyone could do anything with it, but he can sell it, or they can sell it, to just one person or three people as a series, and then those people are the official owners of the work. So, sure. And the idea is that you buy this little graphic file or whatever it is at a certain price and you're registered to it on the blockchain. And then someday in the future, it's going to be worth more. So it's more like stock or trading cards or some little Pokemon collectibles or something. And I get it. And the one thing I like about it is that artists who may have been unable to make money with their work because it was digital now have a way to sell to collectors who want some, you know, monetary security. They want to know that this is exclusive, that it's scarce. It's the same problem that early photographic artists had making any money as artists on photographic prints, because people would say, well, it's just a photograph. You can make thousands of them. So artists would make 25 prints and then destroy the negative as a way of creating artificial scarcity. So, you know, there's just 25 of these things. That's what NFTs do for graphics. But I feel like NFTs, the way they're being used by artists now, they're kind of missing the whole point. What people are doing now is NFTs, which are computer programs, really. They can do anything. You can program an NFT to give you 10% every time someone resells your piece of work. You can do all sorts of things. You program it into the blockchain so that every time there's a transaction, it can initiate a whole series of other events. If you want to do NFTs, then you should be using the programming to do the art. People doing NFTs of just graphic images, that reminds me of like using the internet to stream television. Sure, you can use the internet to watch Netflix, but that's not taking the medium of the internet, of digital, into account. It's just using this medium to show the previous medium's form of content. So what I want to propose is that people use NFTs programming to do what we used to call art. And that means using the programming of the NFT to critique society or the art market or the collectors or NFTs themselves. Like, what about an NFT that it can only be sold for less than whatever it was purchased for, right? So you buy a piece of art and you're allowed to sell it, but you have to sell it for a lower amount. Or what about an NFT, what about a fungible NFT, a fungible, non-fungible token that will spawn copies of the original artwork whenever it's sold, right? So it undermines the whole notion. You know, the current NFT market in some ways is anti-art in that it's simply reinforcing capitalism. In some ways, I saw a NFT done by Charmin, the toilet paper company, and they call it an NFTP. Get it? It's an NFTP, toilet paper. That, to me, it's funny enough, that's closer to a critique of NFTs than Banksy, who's a real artist, selling some piece of his work as an NFT. I mean, what are the things that we want to call attention to with art? What are the things we want to call attention to with a token, with a programmable work of art? Do we want to call attention to capitalism as a religion? Do we want to call attention to this way that markets create false scarcity in order for things to be valued? Do we want to challenge why people invest in NFTs, why tokens have value? Do we want to expose this giant energy-consuming funeral pyre that we're burning in praise of cash, in praise of money? That's all Bitcoin really is. That's all proof of work means, is that we are willing to burn fossil fuels or burn renewable energy, as if there really were such a thing. We're willing to spend energy that does nothing other than confirm our faith in this form of money. Oh, does this money mean anything? Yes, I'm willing to burn things. The whole planet is willing to burn 5% of its energy as a way of saying, we believe in you, Bitcoin. We believe. So what about making an NFT that exposes that, that exposes this craziness, that exposes the art scene, that exposes who and what we are at this moment in time? That's the kind of NFT I'd invest in, one that actually does the opposite of what most of the current NFTs are doing. That's what counterculture is. That's what art is. That's when you're actually playing with something. My friend Kenya Robinson is a multimedia artist and performer who explores race, gender, and ability. Her work has been everywhere, a MoMA, the Kitchen, Museum of Contemporary Diasporan Arts, museums, and universities all over the world. It's hard to convey the humanity and accessibility of her work, and not because it's so easy, but because it's just true in the purest experiential sense. And as you know by now, I don't do real interviews in this show, but I think this conversation goes a long way toward conveying the essence of Kenya Robinson's journey. So Kenya Robinson, you're an artist and international Southerner, mischief maker,
indeed,
and shit starter of the very greatest kind. And in the bio on one of those art things, it said you investigate gender, consumerism, and ability through unexpected performative actions and sculptural gestures, which I love, because performative actions, as opposed to performance art, it's like, oh, actions. And then instead of sculpture, it's sculptural gestures, which just encompasses so, that could be your body. It could be the way you're standing. This is a sculptural gesture. So one of those sculptural gestures was, I suppose, in response to a prompt that I want to find out what it was for this art show in Canada. And there's all these pictures and stuff. And then there's this beautiful pink, swirly, lump, like turban-like epoxy-ish blob of cake that's sitting on two rectangular placemat doily things of other pink flesh-like, you know, Caucasian pink color.
I mean, in some circles, yes, Caucasian pink.
it's a Caucasian pink or Band-Aid pink.
Oh, yes. Yes.
But certainly cake pink, and it's called, I was going to call it, If I Knowed You Was Coming, but it's not. It's not. It's actually supposed to be, If I'd Known You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked You a Cake.
And it's I'd Have, because I love that contraction. I'm like, what? Two contractions in one? I would have? What?
Yeah.
It's so crazy.
And the piece is sort of like that, because it's not just a cake. It's a cake that, it's a sculpture of a cake that does to cake what I'd Have does to I Would Have.
Thank
Let me you. Just put it that way.
I mean, you know what it is. You know what it is.
Yeah.
You saw it.
Oh, I love it. I love it. And anybody can go see it by searching for Kenya Robinson and cake and some words, you know, use your Boolean abilities, people. But it's beautiful. So what, can we talk about that piece? Because it's just gorgeous.
Sure.
What was the prompt? How does that happen?
Okay, so when I travel, I get two kinds of books. I get sugary chiclet and or like self-help. Like, you know, sometimes it'll be like a, you know, how to sell, or, you know, it's like something crazy, right? And I read Crazy Rich Asians when it first came out, because, I mean, like, that's like chick lit, you know, romantic comedy. Mm-hmm. And there's a scene in this book where they're like, ugh, they're trying to find kind of a minor character. And they're like, oh, he's probably somewhere watching cake sitting videos on YouTube. And I was like, what? I mean, like you babysitting a cake? You watching the cake? Like, I didn't know, I had no idea what that could be referring to. So I'm like, okay, we'll go to YouTube and type in cake sitting. And then I got exposed to this whole world, this fetish world of bitches sitting on cakes.
With clothes or naked?
Mostly with like clothes. Like, they'll have on like hosiery.
Right.
I mean, they're, you know, like, they'll have on a corset.
So it's not a sex thing.
It is a, it, Come on.
Oh, it is.
She's sitting on a cake. It was like, it's definitely sexual. So okay. I'm looking at this thing and it's like, it's video after video after video of the same performative action. You know, I was noticing that like there were people who had quite a following and there would be people that would give them a donation and then they would have this, you know, cake with the donators, the requestees, the requester's handle or whatever, like written on it. And they'd show the cake and they'd, you know, display the cake and it's all silent. Mm. There's usually, I don't think I watched any at that time with any music or anything like that. But oftentimes you wouldn't see the person's head, but they would definitely be female presenting and they would have on different like lingerie, corsets, whatever, but they would never be nude. And they would sit on the cake and then they would sit on the cake and then they would like stand up and then they would do like the 360. So you see like the cake stuck to her butt.
Right.
And that would be the video. And I watched a number of these because I was thinking, well, there's got to be like something else going on in terms of like the stylings of cake sitting.
Right.
But there wasn't. Now this, I must have been watching this like in 2017. I was watching a lot of them. And I was like, wait, it seems like the money shot is kind of missing. Like, why aren't you getting the shot from underneath? You know, like you could just get a clear IKEA chair, no promo, and like just shoot from underneath and you could have this like crazily abstract, but then also not. And, you know, because it didn't mean that you couldn't have the same kind of like stand up, turn around, whatever, but like to not have that as an option just seemed like, you know, a missed opportunity. So I used my power as an artist to make that happen. I actually at the time was working in the equipment studio at the New School. And so I had access to like monitors and macro lenses and lights. And so I just went over to my friend's house and we baked some cakes and got a clear acrylic chair and I started sitting on them. So that's where that came from.
And then this is almost a post-ritual artifact. I mean, it's not a leftover from that experience, but...
No. I did get another cake and I did sit on it. And then we took a mold of the cake that I sat on. Because it's like, okay, we could, you know, it doesn't have to be just this thing. It could be like kind of a mirror. Because that's kind of like what I was thinking about. Like, what's in the mirror dimension of this cake sitting. Mm. So, you know, I wanted to do that sculpturally and I was able to do so with the help of a really, really talented, like basically fabricator sculptor herself, Vanessa Solomon, who has like worked with everybody and somehow I stumbled upon a collaborative relationship with her too.
I mean, and that is this qualifies as sculptural gesture, if anything does, right? Because it's a gesture made sculptural that then becomes a sculptural gesture. I mean, it's everything, right? It's a record of the thing and it's a thing in itself and it's posterity.
Yeah.
And it's
and
just
posterior.
And it's and posterior. Posterior, posterior. Exactly. It is true posterity. It oh my God. But this is the thing that for me so characterizes your work is that it's both performative and art. And not, I don't mean it in the bad way, but it's hard, but it's also easy. It's like easy in. It's hard once you've been with it a while. It gets harder, but it's so at first glance accessible. Like you did this thing, I don't know if you would probably remember when you, where was it? At the kitchen where you're in the raincoat eating crackers?
Yeah.
what was that called?
Can you eat a cracker?
Oh, there you go. There you go. You see, it's accessible, right? It's not called like, you know, Martian visions of exteriority, right? It's called Can You Eat a Cracker?
Yeah.
In a raincoat at the kitchen.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be my parentheses added to it.
Yeah.
But
which I got the idea from the story on the back of the matzah crackers. I was in a residency at Triangle Arts, and there was an artist, Dominic Terlizzi, who does was making these bronze pieces out of crackers. So he had all kinds of crackers. And then we had this whole conversation about crackers because I'm from Florida, and that's, you know, oftentimes what I use to refer to white people. And so I read this whole story, and I was like, wow, you know, I know all of these packages have this, like, I don't even know what they're trying to do with all of the text on the back of a Triscuit, but it's like, it's all kind of like information, and we get it from white winter wheat, and this is great for snacking or partying or anytime. Like, I was just like, wow, this seems like a lot of text for a box of crackers. And so, you know, that was a whole story, but it made me investigate the backs of other crackers and, you know, put it together as a kind of a manifesto. And then all of the expiration dates, I ended up like researching them, because of course every day on the calendar is significant at some point. And so it was all this kind of like, you know, like one of them was like the Battle of Gettysburg, and one was like, and it might have been the same day that Oprah, you know, got her first show, like her show, first air date of her syndicated show when it went national. And, you know, it was just like all these like really wonderful coincidences. But that was playing in the background as I was eating crackers.
Right. And then I love, because I saw, the reason I remembered the show is I saw one of the reviews online, and it says, Robinson seems wonderfully out of touch with the times. And I can't think of a better compliment, actually, than that. Do you know what I mean? Because it's like, you know, because I mean, someone could be upset hearing that. Oh, I mean, I'm not with the times. It's like, oh, thank God, I'm not with the times. I've transcended the times. I am timeless, you know?
You know what? Yes, exactly. Exactly. And, you know, but it's like, it's great when, you know, whatever you're doing elicits that in other people. Because it's like, you can't say that. You can't say, I do, because that's just my personality. But like, it can't be historicized in the same way. If I say I'm timeless, you know, it has to be someone who somehow gleans that for themselves from watching and hopefully resonating with the work.
Right. And they're seeing, I mean, and they get it. I mean, what you do so well is you juxtapose things, you know, you take normal things and then stick them together. And then it's like, what? Crackers and raincoat. Wait a minute. What? Wait, what? What? Is it for the crumbs? What's going on? What's she being protected from? What? It's that thing, you know? It's like in all the chronicles of your inflatable mattress project, which is kind of like, you know, couch surfing as art. Now, the idea because I wasn't one of your host homes, so I didn't actually watch it happen, but that you would go to someone's house with an inflatable mattress and they would have to supply you with toothpaste.
Yeah. Yeah.
And otherwise, you are pretty self-sufficient.
Yeah. And, you know, I can't remember how many hours it was now, but it was like, I also was like, okay, I can even give you whatever hours of 10 hours of labor, let's say, while I'm there. And I'll do anything except exchange bodily fluids or launder intimate apparel. You know, I had to, you know, you got to create some boundaries.
Right. Exactly. Oh, exactly. Otherwise, yeah, it gets a little weird. Yeah. But it's a nice, it's nice because you're, I mean, it's hard for those of us regular people to kind of fully grok what it is to be living as an artist. And you, and part of the reason I'm so interested in you is you move through life as part of your work, but you do it in an admirable way, right? Because when I went to art school, right? Like, you know, all privileged little white kids did, you know, who got interested in the arts, right? Mommy and daddy, they sent me to CalArts. And I go to CalArts, and it's like, it felt like half the people at CalArts were trying to figure out how to adopt the persona of an artist more than they were caring about their work. You know, and it got me so fed up. It's, you dress like an artist so well. But it's like, where's your work? It's like, that doesn't matter. They dress like her. They talk like her. They got their hair cut. They could talk about Warhol. Right. You know, it's like, whatever. Where's your friggin' work? You know, and it wasn't there. But it wasn't until I saw you, the way you move through reality, that I was like, oh, but there is a place for that too, where the boundary between the work and the way you exist
right.
goes away. Where did that come from? Or did you just born pop out like that?
I definitely think I popped out like that. I didn't know that I was an artist. Like I always knew I was creative. That was always nurtured. But I think that it was really difficult for the people around me who were consistently around me to identify exactly how that was going to be kind of come all together. Because I, like, you know, I was in theater, and what would happen is that I would make my own costumes for the production. And it was like, people were really appreciative of my efforts, but it wasn't like they understood that this was me working out some things that was really me creating an artistic practice. You know, nobody identified it. And actually no one identified it until I moved to New York. And there were other artists there that like they took one look at me, had one conversation, and they're just like, you know, you're an artist, right? Like I'd had a number of those kinds of conversations. Like I'd be like, ooh, wouldn't it be cool if somebody did da 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 da? And, you know, because I had gone to fashion design school, I had all of these tools to track a creative exploration, you know, like whether it was a sketchbook or, you know, writing or like researching. So I had a lot of those tools already. And I had the most important one, which is that art is anything that makes an idea tangible in some way. Because, you know, growing up, an artist was someone who like made sculpture out of like wood or stone or drew realistically or painted. And I didn't do any of those things. So I just didn't, it didn't even occur to me as an identity that I was actually cultivating through all these adventures.
Right.
So it's been easy to kind of like, you know, fold it in, like hanging out with my friends could easily turn into a project.
Right. And then, I mean, and that's the whole trick, is so many people who do the kind of work that might emerge out of hanging out with my friends, they don't then also bring, what would be the word, virtuosity to it. It's great that the ideas emerge out of life and casual encounter and all that, but then it's like the real artist brings this kind of a rigor to it that's not always obvious. It's not like some Caravaggio painting rigor, but it's a kind of I didn't say that word right. See, I didn't really go to art school. I was theater school, but it was part of an art school. But you know who I mean, like that big painter guy.
Yep.
So you do a project, like my favorite thing. I was going to wait till the end, but where you bring the little white guy around.
Yeah.
What's it called? There's a white man in my pocket?
Yeah, white man in my pocket. Hashtag.
But it's all these photographs and Instagrams of things with this little white man statue doll thing, like looking at posters or gum machines or whatever. He's like just looking at the world, but he's so little, or he's just like this, he's wedged in somewhere on your body, just your little guy. But the amount of thought that spills out of that thing is really insane. Do you know what I mean? How much it makes one, especially, you know, as a white guy relating to a black woman and the size difference. And but you're kind of nice to him. You're kind of nicer to him than white men were to you at the same time. You know what I mean? There's just so much wonder and stuff in it. But why is that better than if I did it? Is sort of the question I'm asking. Where is the rigor and the art and the thought? Why does that work so well?
Well, I mean, it is absolutely enhanced by my embodiment, you know, like the juxtaposition between what white heteronormative masculinity represents and what, you know, Black femme queerness, for example, represents. It's like they're meeting each other in this really unexpected way, because we know how to digest a Black woman and a white man having, like, you know, whatever conflict. You know, we kind of have, we have tropes for it. We have theories for it. We have a even an entertainment history, you know, through popular culture of the roles that each of these individuals play. But I think when you use the white man in my pocket as a talisman to talk about privilege, and what does privilege actually mean? And what does, yeah, what is it plastic material, which is what I often posit, not just because it's plastic arts, like it can be manipulated, but, like, you know, the geologists still don't know the half-life of plastic. And, you know, we're having this whole conversation about how it's going to be in the geological record and, like, what's that going to mean, you know, however many millions of years from now. You know, I think that that's the same kinds of questions I ask of, like, all kinds of isms and archies. It's a way for you to have those questions as a witness that I don't have to tell you. Like, I'm sharing it with you because we're having this conversation. But so often this, I can tell that it's happening with the other person because of their reaction to it. Like, I remember I maybe had been carrying Dave in my pocket for, like, or somewhere. It was, like, really starting to develop as, like, I'm like, this actually might last longer than, like, a month. I mean, it ended up lasting for 4 years, but, like, you know, this might go on for, like, an extended period of time. Early on, I had this experience at this, I was house sitting at a friend's house who lived in Sunset Park, and there was this Chinese bakery that I would go to all the time. I mean, they had been living there for years. I had been going there for years. You know, they're usually very, like, no nonsense. It's just like, what do you want? Tea, egg, coffee. The subway was right by it. So I would go to work. And so it's like, everybody's there. And for some reason I was, like, digging in my bag to get some change, and to make room, I put him kind of, like, absentmindedly on the counter. And the woman behind the counter, who, like, I don't think we had ever exchanged any words of English, you know, other than, like, coffee and tea egg. And she starts chuckling. I'll never know what her internal dialogue was about that, but I realized that, because obviously, you know, humor plays a big part in the way I think, you know, and subsequently my artwork. And I do think that Dave is funny. And so if I can get the lady at the Chinese bakery who doesn't say more than a few words to me to have a private moment of humor, then I probably have something there. And so it really encouraged me to commit even more and see what happens with this thing over time.
Yeah, so it's almost like you follow an intuition, and the polemic or the meaning of it emerges as you do it to you and everyone.
Yep.
But it's that intuition, you know, of what to juxtapose in order to sort of unleash this stuff, mm-hmm. you know, because now we're in the heart of the, you know, the white privilege conversation, finally, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, like, nobody was having that conversation in 2013.
Right.
No one was, like, talking about that. No one. And so it was really almost 4 years before, you know, this kind of, like, already by that time, 5 years into that, the 8 years of the Obama administration. So definitely nobody was having that conversation.
Right. Well, so many people got elected. Okay. And Oprah cried. So we're done. You know, we finished.
Mm-hmm. Whew. That was some hard work, wasn't it?
Yeah. Oh, well.
Oh, well.
But your work doesn't, at least it doesn't to me, have, I mean, it gets scary the deeper you go into it, but it never presents itself as angry up front. You know, it's very white friendly, you know, mm-hmm. or Jew friendly or whatever I am, you know, right. It's like, oh, it's an invitation to now start thinking and then reflecting, which is, I mean, and I know it's not everybody's cup of tea. Some people want, you know, no, you got to slap them in the face right up front and all that, make them suffer and
right.
all that. But you don't, yours is an invitation. We can suffer if we want to, if we need to.
Right.
We can still find that in the work and push all the way through to redemption, maybe. But
hopefully. But I, you know, one of the things that was interesting about Dave was that, you know, there was an unexpected return of empathy because I was like, you know, it must be very difficult, you know, to occupy this space. Like the ism assigns people. And there are expectations related to the assignment. And there's a lot of expectations related to all the identities, but certainly the biggest myth of it all is this white heteronormative masculine figure. And, you know, like I one time I was at a talk at, it was like one of these small, like private liberal arts colleges, like in Massachusetts. You know, it was like one of those colleges, like colleges that will change your life. And it was one of right. them. And it was a freshman student who actually, you know, organized me to come up there and give a talk and studio visits and stuff. And we were having dinner, you know, at a place not far away from the campus. And I was carrying Dave by this time, within the first year. And I put Dave on the table as we were dining. And there was a couple, a white couple that was dining, like, you know, next to us, like probably, you know, middle-aged, probably were somehow involved, like connected to the university. And the man, like, was asking about that. I don't know if he had read something, but he came over there and he, like, swooped down. And he, like, at one point, he raised his voice. It was like, wow, this little figure, because, I mean, you know, I don't know what it doesn't even matter what I said to get him that upset, because it really wasn't anything that I said. It was the fact that I explained to him, I might've just explained to him this exploration, because that's what it was at the time.
Right.
And I already had the name for it in terms of like the name of the figure himself and also the project. And I was like, you know, it certainly, that pressure of that assignment that is encouraging this response. And so, you know, it continues to remind me, which is, I think, why this approach of like, okay, like, I'm going to invite you in, one, because I like being a host, and then two, because I know that despite all of these isms, we are all having a human experience. Like, nobody is avoiding that. Nobody is sidestepping being born. Nobody is sidestepping the tremendous paradox of living and dying at the same time and the uncertainty of when that moment is going to happen. Everybody has that. And so I'm not going to let racism and sexism and these hierarchies that are put in place for, you know, reasons of extraction completely distract me from that fact.
Right. I get scared though, you know, because even, you know, here I am doing Team Human, right?
Right.
And Team Human itself, me just saying we're all human, is now on the white supremacy, you know, pyramid.
Right.
You know, it's down near the bottom, but it's part of it. It's, right. You know, along with Rodney King, why can't we all just get along? It's part of, it's considered part of the problem. Mm. And it's hard for me to think of myself as Jew first or, you know, white appearing first, because, you know, until 1970, we weren't white. But now I get it. We are, because Abe Beam got elected mayor. That's what grandma said was the turning point.
Right.
You know, so now we're considered white. And it's like, oh, do I have to be white first? Can I be human first? And it's hard. I mean, I understand the social justice warrior critique that I got to own up to being the white man,
right,
in it. But at the same time, I'm such a universalist. I'm such a, we're all human first. Does the SJW thing ever feel too strident to you? Or is it something that I should, I gotta try to get with?
You will never see me at a protest. Ever. Mm. You just won't. I think that there was absolutely, and this is going to be interesting how this like telegraphs, you know, but it's like, I think that, like, you know, I'm looking at, you know, you see growing up the images from the civil rights movement. You know, I have parents and, you know, they are, you know, it's not even that I'm adjacent, but they couldn't check out a library book and they grew up in segregated schools and so on and so forth. So I'm not unaware or naive, you know, and not even willfully naive about those things. But I know that, like, we are in a different dimension with technology. When the kids got, you know, attacked by the dogs and with the fire hoses, that's when everybody was like, no, not the babies, but they shooting bitches in their bed. And yeah. You know what I'm saying? So it's like, we have to be conscientious of the context of what a protest can do, what that kind of action can do. And I wonder, are we missing out on options that include deceit, spycraft, secrecy, bait and switch, glamour? Are we in the interest of the protest and, like, performing? You know, I've told you this before. I have my, like, five syllogisms, or I don't even know what the word is, but, like, kind of statements about whiteness. And I also have five statements about blackness. And one of them is blackness is a performance of solidarity. Now, performance is different than an action, a response, an intention. It's, you know, those things are tied up into it, but a performance is a distinct thing. And so I think that there's a lot of performance of solidarity through actions like, or experiences like a protest. And that's not something that I'm interested in pursuing. So oftentimes when I'm kind of confronted with, like, what do I think about them? Not much, you know?
Well, I mean, if someone gets, you know, a child gets shot by cops in the building next door, and people go out in the street to say, this is injustice. I mean, that's a protest. I mean,
yeah,
you'd find yourself swept out in that, wouldn't you? Or you think you'd sit at home?
I told you, I will not be there, because the other thing is that like, you're not giving new information. We all know that it's an injustice. Even the person who shot the person,
right,
knows that it's an injustice.
Right. Whether or not they're trying to get away with it,
right,
they still know.
They know. So I think that,
right,
that's a kind of a part of also, like, recognizing that humanity is that, like, for me, it's really important to not create this scenario that I present this whatever thing as new information, because it is not. So what else could I do? I'm interested in exploring those things, because I've definitely had a reasonable history of, like, you know, telling what's what from the bottom to the top. And I have found that it is ultimately not beneficial for me. Mm. And then you find out, like, okay, it didn't even benefit me, and the person already knew. I think I might want to explore other options. This is not to say that you can't protest, but I think that there's the rub that, like, you can only protest, or if you're not protesting, then you're not participating on the level of change. And that's just simply not true.
Right. And you know, I saw this widely criticized Pepsi commercial a few years ago that, like, had Kylie Jenner, one of the Jenner girls, yeah, whatever. It's like, and it looks like a BLM sort of Occupy,
yeah,
Kendall Jenner, right? It looks like this Occupy protest, and they're all going and marching, but everybody's beautiful and sort of tan, but not black, but maybe a little black, and this, they're all going around. And then it's like the scene, it almost looks like Kent State, and there's the cops there with the guns or whatever. And then she, like, hands them a Pepsi, and it's okay. And I looked at that, and I know everyone got upset about that commercial. And to me, that commercial was saying, this is performative. There's a performance that she was in some way, not that Pepsi meant it, but they were deconstructing the protest as cool.
Yes. And I totally, that's how I read it. You know, I just watched Coming to America, the sequel. And I thought it was so funny that there's like, I kind of have this theory that all entertainment is symbolic, that all the media that we get, whether it's journalism or like a television series, it's all entertainment. And entertainment is designed to speak on a very populist level. Like, even if it's a niche, it's trying to capture everybody, potential person in that niche. And the way that you can do that most successfully is through symbolic language, because then you don't have to necessarily speak the language or be educated. Something just resonates within you because it's like this symbol from way, way back. Like, you know, we talk about, like, the woo-woo communities, you know, like metaphysical New Agey folks, they talk about this law of gender, you know, this kind of bifurcated thing, which is actually all throughout, like, I mean, digital technology is a zero and a one. It's a binary. And so right. I think that, like, the fact that Pepsi's symbol incorporates, unlike Coca-Cola, for example, incorporates red and blue, these kind of traditional masculine and feminine colors. And the fact that it is echoed in the way our political parties are mascotted. And so, like, I think that I don't believe in coincidences as just like a personal levity. And I thought it was interesting that, like, in Coming to America 2, the fast food, the fictional fast food joint McDowell's, who has now found itself in Zamunda, Pepsi is their official sponsor. So, you know, there was much more that was gained by all of the energy and the froth that was created from it. But I do understand this solidarity. You know, that's performance. Just like I think that whiteness is a performance of ignorance, that it's not true ignorance. It's a kind of like an expectation that you don't know, so you don't know. And you act according, you know, you perform accordingly, I should say.
Right. Only you don't even know that's what you're doing. And then you fail at it because you can't not, right? All these poor little white supremacist boys, you know, looking for the non-castrated male father figure to lead them to a form of masculinity and whiteness that doesn't exist.
Does not exist. Right?
And that's why then who are they going to get angry at, though? The problem is then they get angry at you.
Right.
You know, right. They don't get angry at each other themselves.
And now back to the original point, which is why you will not catch me at a protest. It's much more effective for me to use clandestine means. I'm learning that, like, you know, one of the things that I think is so interesting about, like, the conversation about, like, Harriet Tubman and, like, oh, they're going to put her on, which they, like, don't do that. Don't even put her on that currency. Don't do that. But I know that's a very unpopular opinion. But like, you know, people talk about Harriet Tubman almost exclusively in terms of the Underground Railroad. And we know that, I can't remember what the number of people that she was able to lead to freedom in, you know, during her trips. But I do know that all of the people were, even if it was through a couple of degrees of separation, were already connected to her in some way. Like, she wasn't doing this for strangers, for complete strangers. That was not happening. And so there's going to be a limitation, one, because she is one person, and two, because, you know, the connections can only go so far. But, you know, the thing that I'm most intrigued by is her work as a spy for the Union forces. Let's say, and I think this would be generous, let's say she led 150 people to freedom. I don't think it's that many, but, like, let's say.
Yeah.
Think about the ability for, you know, like, the Union Army to make some, you know, moves that helped in their quest, or the fact that one of the, you know, some scholars say, you know, kind of the biggest turn of the tide was the fact that Black men could fight, because, you know, as a matter of philosophy, you couldn't have Negroes fighting for, you know what I mean? Who would give them a gun? I mean, I wouldn't.
Yeah. That's what we have gun control for.
Right.
Is mainly exactly. That.
Exactly. And so, you know, those kinds of actions, those kinds of commitments towards espionage were much more impactful than her acts as a one person leading these groups. And I think it's no accident that's not spoken about, because it's like, oh, wait a minute. Are you suggesting that secrecy could be a tool also? That you could develop that? You know, the ism, particularly in reference to Black people, conditions you to lay all your cards on the table as, like, a facet of your identity, that you're authentic, that you're real, when actually you might be best benefited by not revealing all that stuff. And the other part is that, like, when you hold some things to the vest, you give your opponent, for lack of a better term, an opportunity to reveal more about themselves. As the more information that I get, the more I'm drawn back into the universality of a human experience.
Right. You kind of hold back. I mean, it's true. It's in your work, obviously, as well. So I'm going to put it out there. I'm not going to quite say what this is. And then you let people reveal who they are by how they respond to it. And then that folds into the next piece of work that you do. And it's such a liberating feeling then. But you can also, that's the fun thing about your work. I could feel liberated. I could feel ashamed. But that's fun too. It's like, oh, why did I just feel shame? It's like, ooh, she got me. Now I'm going to have to unfold this thing over a period of weeks, right?
Right.
But that's good. And no one has to know. This is private now. I get to unfold it myself.
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly. No one has to know. It's just like, you know, you might not ever say it to me. You might, like, and that's exactly what I am. You know, of course you don't know at first as you're developing your practice that that's what you want to do and that's what you're doing. But like you said, so much of the work comes in the doing, you know, and I think that this is because I was a graphic designer. You know, there are a lot of artists who are really just graphic designers. You know, they already know what the outcome is. They know what the outcome is for their work. And then they like kind of work, they reverse engineer it.
Right.
And then they put in this stuff. And I have a sense of what I want to do. And it's not that I'm not willy-nilly about it, but I'm oftentimes put and also actively putting myself in a position to be taught by the practice to like shift my focus to like allow more information to influence what the thing looks like, what the experience is.
Well, especially if it's going to take a year or two or three or four.
Right.
You go in with an intention and a practice, but then it's process oriented. It has to be.
Yes.
You know, you're not making a thing.
No.
You're
no.
You know, you might leave an artifact or two, but something's happened in time and space. You know? That's the work.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. And being able to like, you know, fortunately like stuff, you know, enough to know that I want to have an artifact that you know, that that can come through, because then, you know, my dealer likes that.
Right. There's so much going on. It's like stock photography of Black people.
Oh, yes.
Project.
Yes.
Blixel.
Yes.
Blixel.
Yes.
Get it? Like Pixel, but Blixel.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, my God. That is fun. Because it's like on one level, it's just Black people, like with VR goggles or different things and stuff. But on the other hand, it's like Black people are not in stock photography.
It's one of those things that I think somebody was saying, says, you know what? Can you do the obvious thing that like, this is a woman who was the former executive director of Art Space in New Haven. And we did a project together and we've maintained a relationship ever since, Helen Cowder. And she was like, you know, it's always a hoot to like see the next thing because it's so obvious. It's almost like, of course. And it's not that someone hasn't thought about Blackness in stock imagery, but like I just so happen to have all these other tools and experiences. Like I have been working with graphic design since, you know, I was in middle school, and you would actually have like clip art wasn't like, you know, a euphemism. It was like you actually
Right.
out of the book, put it on some graph paper with invisible tape, and you photocopied it and you manipulated it that way. So very analog base to when Illustrator and Photoshop didn't even have numbers or CC or anything like that. It was just Photoshop. And so I've also like, strangely enough, like worked as the desktop publisher for at the time it was the second largest nonprofit group in the state of California. And so I had to make all of their forms and documents in duplicate, you know, one in English and one in Spanish. And so I knew and know what the images need to look like for the end user, which would be the graphic designer or the desktop
illustrator. Right.
And so that's what I feel like is missing in a lot of the stock imagery initiatives that are in the marketplace, because it's a great idea. And then there's also that impulse of representation, you know, you want to be seen.
Right.
So oftentimes a lot of these images look like editorials, which I get that impulse, but that's not actually like, there's always representation of exceptionalism in Blackness. Like there's lots of images of celebrities, lots of images, you know, covers of magazines if you are a star. But if I just wanted to get an image of a Black woman who looked like me washing her face, or drinking some water, even more elementary. I couldn't find it. I mean, this is a search in the last 2 weeks, I should say. And I couldn't find like just a Black woman of my complexion or darker having a glass of water.
Right. Not generic. You'll find like Tyra Banks or somebody, right? Or Naomi Campbell. Right. But it's like, where's the generic person?
Where is the everyday person that like looks kind of like your auntie or your cousin or your mother or your grandmother or whatever?
Right.
Really trying to elevate the vernacular, you know, and see the material of the mundane, that there's a lot there because that's where most of us reside on a daily basis. Even people like you or I who have been exposed to exceptional people who have some kind of notoriety in the public sphere. Most of the people that we know are regular people that people don't know what they look like. You sat next to them on the subway, you know, or passed them on the street.
And that's what's more significant to you about the mundane, that it's not who gets on the $20 bill. It's who's in the pictures that we're all looking at and identifying with every single day. Who's in the picture of the person opening up their friggin' smartphone?
Correct.
You know,
it's really interesting, the process, because it's taught me a lot about institutions and kind of decolonize the museum. And, you know, there's a lot of a clamor about this. And, you know, I'm trying to be more and more aware of what the institution actually is, because I think that that's a big part of the problem, is that people are so, they've made up what the institution is instead of looking to see what it is. You know, the institution is by its nature not dynamic, but you want it to be dynamic. And I mean, I just had this experience because I was like, oh, I want this institution to roll with the punches to see, oh, I can't do it like this. Like, I learned this with the first three shoots that I had for Blixel, is that you can't be like, oh, we're having this thing, sign up here. It's very much like, get the number, call them up. This is what and I'm like, I actually know this as a member of the Black community. Like, I want to have, I'm like, the email is kind of like, and it's so funny, there's so many interesting memes about the process of being in a corporate environment as a Black person in general, but it gets down to the point of like emails are so antithetical to the kind of communication that has been nurtured culturally in the Black community. But yet the institution has decided this is how we communicate with people. And I'm like, oh, actually, no, if you want to get more diversity, then you even have to diversify your modes and methods of communication. Mm. And so it can be really difficult to convince the institution of that. And so I'm like, oh, I don't even have to spend my time trying to convince the institution now, because I know that there's not capability there, but the institution could do other things. And that's what I'm learning.
Right. And it's so hard for people to hear that, because it's not, no, email is not racist. It's not that. But it's like, imagine if like I'm trying to get volunteers for my picnic and I always make my announcement at my Torah study group. But why is it always Jews who are showing up in my picnics? I tell at my Torah study, I say, you're all invited.
Right. Exactly.
It's like, well, it's like you meant well, but think about where you're making that announcement, Douglas.
right. Or like, you know, this
so little, hard.
Like, oh, raise your hand. Like, that is another thing. It's like, raise your hand. Like I had this epiphany with my, you know, good white girlfriends about invitations. In general, Black American people do not offer invitations unless they are like, it's not, you know, like, you know, you say, how you doing? And somebody says, fine. Well, they may or may not be fine. It's just like the social right. convention. The invitation is not a social convention. And it took me a long time to understand that this was like, it wasn't for me to actually hang out with you. Like if, like a lot of my white girlfriends, I'd be like, I would be getting offended. But I didn't know that that was a cultural affect that I'm not privy to.
Well, that happens to me though, but maybe it's a Jewish thing too. If someone says, oh, you got to come over sometime. Then I come over, ring the bell. And they're like, what are you doing here? I'm like, you said to come over sometime.
Right.
No, that happens.
Right. I'm not saying like, that it doesn't occur in other, but I'm like, oh, yeah.
Right.
Like it was a reminder. Yeah. It was a reminder that like, even something as cut and dry as that has so much right. nuance.
Yeah.
You know, and so it's up to me because I, as the artist, have a lot of flexibility. The institution does not.
Right.
And so I'm utilizing my energies, I feel like, more effectively, more sustainably by not expecting the institution to be able to alter themselves or itself to accommodate these various kinds of communication.
That's the whole Team Human mission, is to help people see that we've been institutionalized. We are living in institutions, like being put in the little boxes, and it's not conducive to humanity, to connection, to intimacy, to rapport, to all the stuff that gives us the immune response we need, you know, to actually engage in the struggle.
I mean, I think that that is one of the things that, you know, earlier in the conversation, you mentioned that like you felt your interaction with my work was like decidedly not angry. And I realized that like that is like that institutionalized position for Black women and justified, because I have, believe me, I have been justifiably angry and have expressed it. And I'm like, oh, wait a minute. First of all, I'm not really angry. I'm actually hurt. That was like an epiphany. That shifted everything to realize that I actually was hurt about A, B, and C. And to decide, I am going to take permission to share that part because I've been conditioned to share the anger. And I was like, oh my gosh, the only thing the anger does is now I done told you off good. And now you don't want to have the conversation because I probably hurt your feelings too.
Right.
And so like, oh, I'm like, that's clever. I'm like, that's what the ism wants to do. It wants to make sure that we're not having the conversation.
Right.
You know, that we
that's
just,
how the ism keeps itself ism.
Is that, yeah. That's how it gets. I'm like, damn. So I just don't do it anymore. And regardless of whether it circles back around to a point of growth, either way, I'm not further harmed, which is what would happen when I would like go off. So, you know, I am truly, you know, to see your book and like, you know, I was at the library and I knew about it, but like to see it on the shelf and be like, I was like, I am I actually am, you know, I am thrilled about the opportunity to embody a Black femme individual. There are tremendous joys and challenges that come along with it, especially at this time in this place. But we all got born. Like nobody just like appeared. There was a process. All of us had the it might have been shorter for others. It might have been through a canal, might have been through a suture. Doesn't matter. It was still a process that is consistent over eons. And I'm not going to let the ism distract me from that, because I find a lot of beauty in that connection.
Amen. Seriously. It's so good to connect with you. It's important. It's important. I feel like I found the others, you know, there's a lot of people in you actually that I'm meeting.
That's right.
They're not in a schizophrenic way either. They're integrated, but there's just many of you, you know? Mm. Well, thank you. Thank all of you for bringing yourselves to Team Human. And thank you for treating that little white guy in your pocket so beautifully.
Why not?
You know? Why not?
Why not?
Because he just...
But I'm supposed to kick him around, you know what I mean? Like, you know, Dave has been to the Caribbean. You know what I'm saying? Dave done travel. Dave went to Switzerland. Dave went to Berlin.
He's living the life.
You know, Dave had a whole... Dave went to an all-Black party. You know, Dave has witnessed, you know, like very, like, you know, if only people who have a larger, more flesh and blood embodiment of Dave could have the experiences of Dave.
Mm. Yeah.
I think they would absolutely be, you know, and it, like I said, he's a talisman. So somehow, hopefully that's like, you know, some juju on some folks.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're changing a lot of people with Dave, I think.
Dave Fowler.
Thanks for being on Team Human. Our guest today was Kenya Robinson. You can find out more about her work and play at privilegeasplastic.com. As always, you can find out more about Kenya and all of our other guests at teamhuman.fm, where you can also become a supporting member of the team. If you'd like an NFT of this episode, please contact your neighborhood crypto exchange agent. Team Human is produced by Josh Chapdelin and edited by Luke Robert Mason. I'm Douglas Rushkoff, and you've been on Team Human, our last best hope for peeps.